At the General Assembly of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada last year, the Council decided to inaugurate a series of lectures to be known as the Ruth Northcott Lectures. These lectures were to be given by invited speakers at the General Assemblies of the Society. We are fortunate tonight to have as our speaker to give us the first lecture of this series, Dr. Paul Hodge. Dr. Hodge is a graduate of Yale University and obtained his PhD in 1960 from Harvard. In 1960 and 61, he was a postdoctorate fellow at Mount Wilson and Palomar Observatories. Also, at the same time, he was a lecturer at Harvard. And also, at the same time, he was a research fellow of the California Institute of Technology. Now, I think this indicates what the future of Dr. Hodge was. He was obviously to become a cosmologist, because to do all these things at once, he would have to have traveled at or very near the speed of light. From 1961 to 1965, he was assistant professor at the University of California at Berkeley. In 1965, he went to the University of Washington, where he is a professor of astronomy today. Dr. Hodge has a very wide range of astronomical interests. He is interested in the solar system, having worked in the fields of meteoric dust, the interplanetary medium, and planetary surfaces. But he has ranged much further afield. One of his other main interests is in extragalactic problems, that is, in problems of galaxies, evolution of galaxies, particular interest in the Magellanic Clouds, and of course also in the problems of cosmology. He is the author of more than 150 scientific papers, and the author also of at least half a dozen books, of which I am aware. These books deal with solar system astronomy and with galaxies and cosmology. Dr. Hodge tells me that the title of his talk tonight is The Six Steps. What he hasn't told me is where the six steps will lead to. Perhaps he can inform us now. I call on Dr. Hodge.
Thank you very much, John. I hope that I will be able to show where the six steps have led. The six steps to which I refer are the six steps of the development of the universe. I want particularly to bring to your attention tonight the last of those six steps. The sixth state of the universe, the one in which we've just very recently entered. It's a new one, and it concerns us as astronomers, amateur and professional, in a rather personal way. And that's why I want to pay particular attention to it tonight. The first five eras in the history of the universe are understood by the majority opinion, you might say, of astronomers today in terms of an explosive Big Bang cosmology, a cosmology built on the framework of a general relativistic model that is expanding from what cosmologists call a singularity, which to us means something that we couldn't tell from a point. The singularity itself is involved in the first step. And that first step was taken, to the best of our knowledge, about 10 billion years ago. perhaps more. And what I'd like to do first is briefly summarize cosmologists' views of those first five steps, and then introduce you to the sixth. And after that, I can't promise what I'll do. I have slides that cover a variety of subjects, all of which I'll try to relate to this problem. The first stage in the development of the universe has been called the era of chaos. Whether it really existed or not depends on whether or not it's appropriate for us to apply the principles of quantum mechanics to the universe, or to at least to that initial blob that marked the beginning. If we do so, we find that conditions during this first very brief stage are unknowable to us. They're lost in the chaos of the uncertainty principle, and we can never reconstruct the order of events that occurred during this era, and we can never talk specifically about events that occurred at time equals zero. Fortunately, for our peace of mind, this era of chaos didn't last very long. Just one quantum of time, which is about 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. Have to imagine that to yourself for a moment before I go on. The second cosmic era was longer. It lasted, according to the cosmologist E.R. Harrison, something on the order of 1/10,000th of a second. He's called this the era of the hadrons, or the era of the heavy particles. He calculates that the universe at that time must have consisted of a fluid of heavy elementary particles, including the strongly interacting particles, as the physicists call them, the mesons and the baryons. And at this time, the density, at the beginning of this era, of the universe was rather high, but it's something we could calculate. It's 10 to the 94th power, grams per cubic centimeter. Very high density compared to what we're used to in the laboratory. The temperature at that time was 10 to the 33rd degrees. And I can't remember whether that's centigrade or absolute, but I don't think it was. Now, this, as I said, lasted about 1/10,000th of a second. And at the end of this period, the temperature and the density had both dropped dramatically. The temperature became 1,000,000,000 degrees in that interval, and the density dropped to 10 to the 14th grams per cubic centimeter. This is something we can almost imagine if we think about black holes and even white dwarfs. In the meantime, during this interval, most of those heavy particles had annihilated each other. At least in the prevailing view, they existed more or less in equal amounts of ordinary matter and antimatter. Not quite, but almost. And this interval was the time during which the matter and the antimatter got together in an explosive way, annihilating themselves. Only a few left. Now, the third era of the universe has been called the era of the leptons, because leptons, this sounds a little bit like a zoo if you're not familiar with physics and elementary particles. Leptons are not animals of a sort in the zodiac, but instead are the smaller elementary particles, the electrons and the muons and the neutrinos, and their counterparts. And they dominated the universe for about 10 seconds. The next 10 seconds. And the most important event during this time was the decoupling of the neutrinos. Now, this means that the neutrinos, which are very elusive objects, you can't stop a neutrino and have anything left. It has a zero rest mass, apparently. Its mass only exists because of its motion. These neutrinos were extremely abundant during the third era, but during this time, they separated themselves from the rest of the universe. The density became sufficiently low that the neutrinos stopped interacting with other things. They have a very low cross-section of interaction, so they stopped interaction. And as far as active participation is concerned, they left the universe, making up a sort of a superimposed neutrino universe of their own. And as far as we know, that still exists superimposed on us. In the meantime, during these 10 seconds, the temperature dropped to a mere 10 billion degrees, and the density fell to something like 10,000 grams per cubic centimeter. Now, the next era, the fourth, lasted something like a million years. It can be called the era of radiation, because during this time, the universe apparently was flooded with light. The photon density, the number of light photon, the light quanta per cubic centimeter, was far greater than the matter density, the number of particles per cubic centimeter, or the mass of particles per cubic centimeter. And the matter consisted primarily of those few electrons and protons and neutrons that survived annihilation during the previous two phases. The matter and the light during this period continued to interact until the temperature fell increasingly slowly to a value of about 3,000 degrees. With this temperature and a density of something like 10 now to the power minus 21 grams per cubic centimeter, the universe passed from the radiation-dominated state to a matter-dominated state. At this time, fluctuations in the density and the temperature could, we hope, lead to the eventual formation of galaxies and stars, and thus started the era of matter, the fifth stage in the development, the one which has just recently ended. We're now entering a new stage, which I'd like to call the era of intelligence. To the best of our knowledge, the universe has lasted for some 10 billion years without realizing it. Our success in discovering the universe means that its creation has become much more than some idle cosmic experiment. It means that this venture called existence has succeeded in a remarkable and sometimes, I think, perhaps unexpected way. At least locally, it's changed only this cosmic moment from a blind, dumb, and ignorant assemblage of particles and waves into what you might have to call an organism, an intelligence, a system that has turned back to look at itself and its history, and one that understands. For all we know, without the knowledge that you and your fellow astronomers, amateurs and professionals throughout the world, the universe would remain ignorant, adrift in the sea of the laws of physics. We've now taken the step that changes that universe that we previously had from its ignorant state to a state of intelligence. Now, the step's only begun, of course. You might say the foot is still in the air, and there remains a tremendous job for us to make certain that this step is completed and that its importance is realized. Not only must we pursue this knowledge further as far as we can and share it with all men
But, of course, we also must preserve it and ourselves so that the sixth error doesn't, through some accident of war, for example, come to a temporary end. Of course, we're probably, when you think of it, not the only astronomers in the universe. There may well be others throughout the cosmos. And when I say we, therefore, I mean members of the intergalactic as well as the International Astronomical Union. But the point is that it seems to take, as near as we can tell, about 10 billion years for nature to produce an organism sufficiently sophisticated to become an astronomer. Now, that sounds perhaps a little pompous, but I think that it is an interesting fact that it takes so long, or at least it has locally, for the universe to find some part of itself that can understand itself, that can see itself, and that can trace its history. Now, it's very possible that elsewhere this happens sooner. But I don't think it's likely that it happened very much sooner. I won't quibble over a billion years. Now, the human record of technological competence is extremely short, of course, compared to the age of our solar system, certainly the age of the universe. If you liken the age of the Earth to a mile's walk, then the period of mankind's modern scientific history is 1/1000th of an inch at the end of that walk. Now, we are told that there's possibly 100 billion planets in our galaxy alone. And it's likely, unlikely if 100 billion people should all start out on a mile's walk, that they would all reach the last 1/1000th of an inch at precisely the same time. Therefore, I don't think it's necessarily true that all of the astronomers of the universe are in existence in our state of sophistication right at this time. Well, we have achieved space travel, and with our radio telescopes, we can send and receive signals from great distances so that any intelligent beings on one or another of those 100 billion planets could easily have passed the point that we've reached, maybe millions of years ago, and possibly now they're unimaginably more competent than we are. But we're always left with the question of where are they? Possibly the planetarium show will answer that question tonight. But aside from that, I would put to you that at least I haven't detected them visiting us. And as far as I know, we haven't been detected by them in any way that we can tell. Scientists have pondered the question of why they haven't come and introduced themselves. An appropriate place, I think, would be at a meeting like this. Generally speaking, scientists have come up with four possibilities to answer that question. One possibility is that we are alone. No other life exists nearby. Ours is one, say, in 100 billion. Another possibility that's almost the same thing is that we are the first. Happy chance has put us ahead of everyone else. Now, of course, this seems very unlikely if there are 100 billion other planets to compete with. But it's not possible to say that it's improbable. If there is only one planet so far that has astronomers on it, then it's very likely that we're on that planet. On this point, I'd like to also mention that we have a cosmical advantage. This doesn't really apply in our galaxy, but when you take the whole cosmos into account, we have an advantage over the distant galaxies. I'll have to admit that the mirror shows that they have an advantage over us, but that's not our concern. If you consider that, let's say, a distant galaxy halfway out, as far as we're concerned, is only half as old as we are, then you realize that we have twice the chance to produce intelligence than they. So no matter which direction you look out, we're looking at more and more infantile galaxies, and therefore less and less probability of superiority to us. Now, a third possibility that's put forward is that we have been discovered by superior beings, and they've come and they've gone. I notice in the airport it's possible to buy at least three different books that have this as their thesis. And people are finding evidence of spacemen having built the pyramids of Egypt and the pyramids of Central America, and I don't know what else. Well, I'm not convinced by the evidence yet. The geological records that we have really don't provide a convincing clue that such a visit has occurred. But more important, I think, and more to the point, is the lack of any recognized garbage on the moon. In the years that we have visited the moon, we've littered it rather shamelessly. But that surface was found by us to be unviolated by anyone else's visit, as far as we could see. It's apparently lain just as it is for 3.5 billion years. I hope that further lunar exploration will become possible, and maybe that will prove me wrong as more and more of the lunar surface is explored. The fourth possibility is a very dismal one, and yet people have proposed it. And that is that civilizations, as organisms, never survive beyond a certain point. Just about the time that they have radio telescopes and the capability of spaceflight, they also find the potential to blow themselves up, and they proceed to do so very promptly. Now, if that last choice is correct, then I think it's our duty, because of our cosmic perspective as astronomers, to bring the lessons of the stars to the Earth and to let men see what he'll miss if he follows that pattern, and to give him a chance to be an exception to that rule, to be intelligent life that jumps that barrier, that learns to control himself and his primitive instincts before it is too late. Astronomy tells us that billions of other worlds lie out there in space to be explored, and billions of years lie out there in the future to be lived. And this transition that we've just witnessed into the era of intelligence has, in any case, definitely begun now. And, at least locally, the responsibility is ours to continue it. Now, I don't want to dwell on the question of life elsewhere, especially since a lecture in either the last year or the year before that dwelt much more confidently than I with the question. But I can't resist at this moment telling you a little bit about a discovery made in my laboratory just a week ago in Seattle. As the introduction maybe told you, one of my scatterbrained interests over many years has been the subject of interplanetary dust. This interest was picked up by me when I was an undergraduate at Yale. I went to school with Malcolm Thompson there, as you may know. And at that time, our hope was to collect interplanetary dust and analyze it and find out what its chemical composition was, and from that, possibly, where it came from. Well, the history of my success, like that of virtually everyone else in this field, has been one embarrassment after another. The problem is, and always has been, that contamination has continuously stopped us from our hoped goal. Contamination first of terrestrial dust in the Earth's atmosphere when experiments were carried out in the Earth's atmosphere as they were many years ago, and later contamination of the experimental dirt of various kinds, including electronic dirt, that plagued almost all of the early rocket and satellite experiments. I also can't resist, now that I've introduced that subject, telling you an example of a source of contamination that was a tremendous discouragement to a predecessor in this field. Willard Fisher was a professor at the Harvard Observatory in the early part of this century. And one of his interests, a hobby really, was the subject of cosmic dust. And he conceived the idea of collecting meteoritic dust in a very simple way, putting out a pan in a remote area, and every day pouring the dust from this pan into a container and looking at it under the microscope. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, I found some of his old records, and I was asked to sort them out. And in the process, I discovered the threads of a rather sad story. And as I put it together, this is what happened. He decided that the best place to make such collections would be the tower at Provincetown, which is a little town at the very end of Cape Cod, which stretches out into the Atlantic. And he drove out to the end of Cape Cod and introduced himself to the janitor and caretaker of the tower, which is about three stories high, involving a spiraling stone staircase to the top. People like to climb the staircase and look out and imagine that they can see across the Atlantic at least a few miles. He talked the caretaker into putting this pan out on the top of this tower, and every day emptying the pan into an envelope and mailing it to him in Cambridge. Well, he went back to Cambridge, and about a week later, the envelope started coming. And every day he got this big, fat envelope. And when he opened it up, tremendous amount of stuff poured out. And he was completely at a loss as to what to do and what had happened. And he was overwhelmed by this tremendous amount of data. It was almost like they had computers in those days. He finally became suspicious that something might be going wrong. And he drove back to Provincetown and knocked on the door of the caretaker. The caretaker said, "Oh, Professor Fisher, I'm so glad to see you. Have you appreciated these envelopes that I've been sending you?" And Dr. Fisher said, "Well," he said, "actually, they've contained quite a bit more material than I expected." And the caretaker said, "Yes, I know," he said. "I was so worried that you would be disappointed when I saw how little there was in the pan that I swept up the stairs into the envelope." Well, that's more or less typical of the experiences we've all had in this field until very recently. Very recently, techniques have reached the point where it's been possible to be very much more careful and much more selective. The most successful experiments that we've carried out have been first experiments using high-altitude balloon flights, which were carried sufficiently high that we were above almost all of the terrestrial sources of dust, and yet sufficiently low that the interplanetary dust itself was decelerated by the upper atmosphere to the point where it could fall into our trap without destroying itself on impact. We also had the problem that plagued others for many years of getting away from the balloon itself as a source of dust. And that was a particularly difficult problem. We had to lower our experiment about a mile below the balloon before the wind shear could prevent us from being in its dust cloud. Well, this method, for the first time, gave us numbers of particles that agreed with the modern current values obtained from spacecraft. Before that, balloons had always gotten something like 1,000 times as many particles as there should be. And we now believe that the reason they got 1,000 times is that they were getting tremendous numbers of particles from the balloon. But the surprise was that even though we were getting the right numbers, we weren't getting the chemistry that we expected. We expected, being naive, I suppose, something like meteorite chemistry, and somehow some of us, not Dr. Brownlee, who really did the experiment, thought maybe it would be mostly nickel and iron. Instead, we got a different chemistry from the nickel-iron meteorites. But the chemistry was almost always precisely the same as the carbonaceous chondrites, which are a rare, at least on the Earth, a rare breed of meteorite that is very rich in carbon. I'll stop talking for a moment and give you three pictures that illustrate some of this material. This is a photograph taken in Palestine, Texas. Showing our balloon collector, designed and built by Dr. Brownlee, taking off for its first successful flight. Now, the carbonaceous chondrites that we found in our collections did not look like this. This is a large one, about 2 centimeters across, but this is what they look like when they are big enough to see without a microscope. Ours were on the order of 10 to 20 microns across. The reason these are called chondrites is that they contain spherical objects within them called chondrules, and this is a photograph of a thin section of the previous meteorite, Allende, which landed in Mexico, taken with polarized light so that you can separate the different minerals simply by the color. It has very little to do with my story, but it's such a pretty picture that Dr. Brown would take. I couldn't resist showing it. Well, our result was somewhat unexpected. We didn't expect to find that almost all the meteoritic dust, had the composition of the carbonaceous chondrites. But we were told by people who knew more about meteorites than we did, and there are many, that it's very possible that in interplanetary space, carbonaceous chondrites are much more common than on the Earth. They are fragile objects, and they break up in the atmosphere very easily, and when they land, they break up even more easily, and they are therefore not very well preserved between the time they leave the interplanetary space and reach the museums. Therefore, it's not too much of a surprise to many people that carbonaceous chondrites might be common in this interplanetary dust, and yet we wanted some kind of a confirmation because we'd been bitten enough times by the problems of contamination in the atmosphere that we wanted to have an independent source of information about the chemistry of these objects. Now, what you cannot easily do is go out into space with a satellite and collect a particle and bring it back and analyze it. And the reason for that is that out in space, the particles have high velocity, sufficiently high, that if whatever you put out to collect it causes its destruction. And all you get is a crater. Now, we'd carried out several experiments in which we collected craters so that we knew how many there were out there. But it was very difficult from just a hole to determine what the chemistry of the object was. And only last week were we fortunate enough to obtain from a Skylab experiment, Skylab 4, a series of pure aluminum surfaces that had been exposed for a long time in space, sufficiently long, that we had craters of considerable size. The largest is 120 microns across, and that's very large. When you, 1,000 microns is a millimeter. And so it's something you can actually see without a microscope. And the reason we were extremely pleased by this was that we hoped there would now be a chance, with such a large crater, that some residue of that particle might be in the bottom of the crater. Now, in recent years, it's been possible, with electron probes, to measure chemical abundances in tiny, tiny areas of an object like a crater. And just last week, Dr. Brownlee succeeded in measuring the chemical abundances of several blobs, only a micron or two across, that he found in the bottom of this Skylab meteoritic dust crater. And they turned out to have carbonaceous chondrite composition almost exactly all the way. So now we feel quite confident that the meteoritic dust, the interplanetary dust that's so common in space between the planets, is chemically like the carbonaceous chondrites. Now, what does that have to do with what I was saying a few moments ago? Well, it's the following thing connects these subjects. And that is the fact that the carbonaceous chondrites not only are rich in carbon, but recent studies have shown that they are rich in complex organic molecules, prebiotic organic molecules. Now, the question of the origin of life has intrigued people, especially in the last 10 years, and there has been a tremendous amount of research into the subject of how, in the early history of the Earth, prebiotic organic molecules may have been generated. And the general feeling is that it was fairly simple. You merely shot some lightning through a hydrogen-rich atmosphere, producing chains that, of organic molecules that eventually could aggregate themselves into something that would be used then to form living things. But what I think we can now say is that there's another source that's possible, and that is the source of the interplanetary dust. Hundreds of thousands of tons of interplanetary dust are falling to the Earth every year, all over the Earth. And according to Dr. Brownlee's experiments with the lunar samples, this has been going on since the solar system formed. In fact, in the early days, at even a higher rate. So the interesting thing is that we've been getting these building blocks for life falling onto the Earth continuously, regardless of what the atmosphere of the Earth may have been. And the other interesting thing is that so have all the other planets. And then the final interesting thing is that these complex organic molecules probably also were formed by whatever mechanism in the pre-solar
nebula produced them in the first place, when other stars formed, and when other solar systems formed. And so it's very likely that these building blocks for life, these prebiotic organic molecules, are the rule in any solar system, in the galaxy, and in the universe. So it's not a particularly far-out idea to imagine that life exists elsewhere. Now, I would like to turn to another subject as a means of apology for a rather one-sided view in giving you these six steps in the history of the universe. I say that the majority opinion is that the universe began as a Big Bang in a general relativistic-like model and has grown through expansion ever since. But there is a minority opinion that's very different from that. You might call it the loyal opposition, with a voice that's getting louder every day. The opposition leader in recent years has been Halton Arp of the Hale Observatories, who has reported increasing amounts of evidence that, in his view, throws serious doubt on the straightforward interpretation of the redshift of galaxies. And in the last couple of years, his voice has been joined by the voices of others. For example, Sir Fred Hoyle and Geoffrey Burbage. Now, if this evidence that Arp and his supporters cite is believable, and I'll discuss that from my biased point of view in a moment, then the Big Bang model of the expanding universe becomes rather less attractive through Occam's razor, and possibly it even becomes unnecessary or wrong, or both. Now, if some of the redshift isn't Doppler redshift, then possibly all of the redshift isn't. And then the universe wouldn't be expanding. Therefore, there's only one stage, one step. Now, the evidence for non-velocity redshifts involves the apparent association in the sky of two or more objects of widely differing redshifts. And the associations that are cited by the ARPists include the following: pairs of quasars with different redshifts, quasars that seem to be around galaxies which have different redshifts from each other, from the galaxy, pairs of galaxies with interconnecting filaments that connect two galaxies with different redshifts, and unstable-looking groups of galaxies that appear near to low redshift larger galaxies. I'd like to show you some examples. Of some of these, this is a group of galaxies called Vrontsov-Yamenov 150. It's called a chain. Oh, now we have a spike across it, don't we? It's a chain of galaxies of presumed association with each other, and they are right close to a bright galaxy, NGC 3718, Yes, 3718, which has a very much smaller redshift. And in ARP's view, this chain of galaxies was spouted out by that large galaxy. Here is what's
popularly known as the Burbage chain of galaxies. And this similarly is very close to a large galaxy, in this case NGC 247, the redshift of which is vastly smaller than the redshift of the individual members of this chain. Another kind of an example is this object, which is Zwicky 215.2 plus 0340. I'd turn the light on for that one. This involves galaxies that seem to be at the end of an arm, or hanging on to the end of an arm of a spiral galaxy. And quite often, the galaxy so involved, in this case down here, has a larger redshift by sometimes very, very great degree than the large galaxy. And in ARP's view, those galaxies have been shot out along that spiral arm by the, you might call, parent galaxy. Finally, here is NGC 5614, which is an example of galaxies that apparently have bridges connecting them, or in this case, what appear to be tidal interactions of one on the other. And in many of ARP's examples of this sort of thing, the redshifts are very greatly different. Now, a very popular group of galaxies that is used in ARPian arguments is the famous Stefan's Quintet. And I want to spend a little bit of time with this problem of Stefan's Quintet, because that's the only one of these objects that I myself have looked at in detail. And I might confess that I look upon the examples that I've described here of non-Doppler cosmology a little bit the way, in a very suspicious way, a little bit the way that you might look upon reports of flying saucers, that you don't want to believe it unless you really see it and experience it yourself. And I feel that way about these experiments. It's so easy to argue one way and the other that you don't have a good feeling for the weight of the arguments without some personal experience. So I'd like now to talk a little bit about the Stefan's Quintet. The Stefan's Quintet was discovered visually 100 years ago with the 31-inch telescope at the Observatoire de Marseille. It consists of five 14th and 15th magnitude galaxies in Pegasus. However, in spite of the fact that it has been examined and photographed for these 100 years, it wasn't until 1961 that someone obtained a spectrum of the brightest and largest of these galaxies, NGC 7320, which is the one right here in the lower left. The other four galaxies had published velocities, and they all agreed roughly with each other. However, there was a spread for those four of about 1,000 kilometers per second, which led Ambartsumian in the 50s to propose that this must be an unstable group. Well, in 1961, the Burbages obtained the spectrogram of the fifth galaxy. And they found that its radial velocity was about 5,000 kilometers per second, less than that of the other four. And the straightforward interpretation of this discovery was that this galaxy is a nearby galaxy, near to us, superimposed by chance on the group and not associated with it at all. And so what we really have is Stefan's quartet, plus a nearby interloper. Arp, however, disputes this view. He believes that all five are at the same distance and that all of them are nearby, and that the four galaxies with large redshifts have non-Doppler redshift components. He believes that this can be explained by saying that all five of these galaxies were only recently spawned by the giant spiral NGC 7331, which he believes has been laying galactic eggs all over that part of the sky. ARP's main argument that this is Stefan's quintet and not Stefan's quartet is based on his independent determinations of the distances of the individual members, which I'll show you in this map. He determined the distance of NGC 7320 and independently the distance of NGC 7318 A and B, using the method that involves measuring the apparent diameters of the giant gas clouds in these galaxies, the H2 regions. It has been said by the oracles in Pasadena that the largest H2 regions in a galaxy are a distance criterion because they're always the same size intrinsically. And using this rule and measuring H2 regions for these galaxies, ARP concluded that the galaxies must be at the same distance because their size distribution was approximately the same. Now, this question touches on some work that I've been doing recently, and so I want to address it. I've been somewhat concerned with the optimism in the statement that the largest H2 regions in galaxies are always the same. I'm not alone in this. Alan Sandage also is concerned about this. Since he is the oracle, I think it's justified concern. I've been measuring diameter functions for galaxies of known distance, and then looking at the effect on population, that is, on luminosity of the galaxy, on size of the galaxy, and on the Hubble type of the galaxy, to find in what way the sizes of the largest H2 regions depend on these parameters. And it turns out that the size of the largest H2 regions is not independent of any of these parameters. It depends on the luminosity of the galaxy, as well as on the type. Just to give you an idea of what some of these things look like, I'll show the next slide. This is NGC 2403 in visual light. And you can see there with the arrows the largest H2 regions in that nearby galaxy. NGC 2403 is an object that you amateurs might enjoy looking at. It's quite a nice object through a small telescope. It's in the M81 group. Therefore, it makes it visible all year from here, doesn't it? The largest H2 regions in this galaxy can be used as calibrators because NGC 2403 is one of the galaxies that the Hale Observatory people, Sandage and Taman in particular, have used for a search for Cepheid variables, and which has become, therefore, a fundamental galaxy in the distance scale problem, because they found the Cepheid variables, they measured their periods and luminosities, and have applied the period-luminosity relationship to it in a very beautiful paper. So we know the distance to this galaxy, and we know the distance to several others, which are close enough for this purpose. However, I'd like to just point out that there are some other interesting features of galaxies when you look at the H2 regions. In addition to the diameter function and the sizes of the largest, and one of them is that the size of the largest H2 region depends very much, not only on the luminosity of the galaxy and its population, not only on its type, but also on how you go about measuring the size. For example, if you use a small telescope, like the 48-inch Schmidt at Palomar, I hope that that would produce a result. If you use a small telescope, then you get a result like this. On the right-hand side is an H-alpha photograph of NGC 628. On the left-hand side is a visual photograph in the V filter band. And what you see there is, on the right-hand side, several of the largest H2 regions in that galaxy. In fact, if you count up the number visible of H2 regions there, it's about 190. But now if you go to a telescope which has those numbers reversed, instead of a 48-inch telescope, if you go to an 84-inch telescope, and if you press the right button, you get this photograph in H-alpha, which I took just a couple of months ago at Kitt Peak. Now we have something like 500 H2 regions visible, and we break some of those very large H2 regions up into groups of smaller ones. Now, if I should use this photograph to calibrate my H2 region criterion, and then measure the distance to this galaxy, I would get a distance of about twice the value, even though it's the same galaxy. So you see, the method that you use to measure the H2 region, the instrument that you use, the resolving power, how deep the plate goes, also becomes rather important. Now, for a further tangential remark and a brief one, I'd like to point out that there's another feature of this particular photograph that's somewhat fun to look at, is the spiral arm structure of this galaxy. It's often said that the H2 regions, because they are the areas where star formation is currently going on, are the bone, the skeleton of the spiral arm structure of a spiral galaxy. So here we see the bones of NGC 628. And we see that, in fact, when you look in sufficient detail at this X-ray picture of its skeleton, that the structure is very much more complicated than most theorists would like. For example, we do see two spiral arms. In fact, we can see three spiral arms if we look long enough. But we also see segments, linear segments, like this and like this. And we see many H2 regions that aren't connected by bone tissue at all, that are just stuck there in the middle between the spiral arms. And the overall pattern is seen to be rather more complicated than the classical two-armed spiral that many theorists talk about. And this is one of the better examples of H2 regions in a spiral galaxy. Well, if we now take what we know about the size distribution of H2 regions and how it varies with the absolute luminosity of a galaxy, and apply it to Stefan's quartet or Stefan's quintet, Then you find that if you assume that the four high redshift galaxies are at their Hubble distance, and if you assume that NGC 7320, the larger, apparently nearer one, is at its Hubble distance, then you would expect the H2 regions, the largest ones, to be about the same apparent size. Because NGC 7320 is comparatively, intrinsically faint because of its nearness compared to the others, and therefore its largest H2 regions are intrinsically smaller. Now, this may be a coincidence, but at least it gives us some indication that Stefan's quintet problem is certainly not yet solved, and that it may, in fact, become solved in a way that is consistent with the traditional conservative view about the redshift. Now, I don't have either the time or the wisdom to discuss all of the other Arpian evidence, but I will unfairly, I think, dispose of all of them with an analogy, just for the time being. ARP's supporters point to two objects in the sky and say, look, the probability that these two things would be close together by chance is very small, maybe one in a million, they calculate it sometimes. Well, these things happen. In a very unfair analogy, consider all of the different cities in the world. What's the probability that I would be found in Winnipeg tonight? You might say, oh, that's one in a thousand. Well, what are the chances, considering all these different cities, that you might be found in Winnipeg tonight? Well, one in a thousand. You multiply these together and you find that the probability that we're both here is about one in a million. Well, now, clearly this is nonsense, and it's probably more nonsense than the statistics used by the ARP school. But nevertheless, I'm reminded of it. I am reminded of a very old joke with which I'd like to close. An astronomer at a meeting went up to another astronomer and said, you look familiar. Didn't we meet at the Vancouver meeting? The other astronomer said, no, I've never been to Vancouver. And the first astronomer said, well, neither have I. Must have been two other people.
Very much indeed, Paul. I can't resist a variation on that story. That was about the fellow who heard that the probability of being found on a plane with a bomb planted on it was one in a thousand. The probability of being on a plane in which two bombs had been planted was one in a million. So this would be absolutely certain he always carried his own bomb with him wherever he went. I'm going to ask John Percy to propose a formal vote of thanks.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's not very much that I could say after Dr. Hodges' talk that's not already obvious to you. Earlier on today, I was commenting on some of the problems in astronomy of making the public aware of what science really was. And I think that tonight Dr. Hodge has acted as a wonderful example of how exciting astronomy can be today. And he's also provided us with an example of how wonderfully a good astronomer can make modern astronomy seem without being overly technical. And I hope that his lecture will act as an inspiration to all of us to go out and try and make astronomy as exciting to the public as he has made it to us tonight. Thank you very much for coming, and we hope you come back to Winnipeg again, even though the probabilities are rather low.
Stevens, are there any local announcements? In a minute or two, we'll just go across the hall.